Brother the Keeper.
We'll see you.
This is Prophecy Keepers Radio, coming to you worldwide on the internet. Visit prophecykeepers.com today.
We'll see you.
Well, hello, everybody. This is your old buddy, Will Bluewater, coming to you from the tops of the Rocky Mountains. And before we introduce our guest this evening, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is secretsofanimmortal.com by Ben Abba. What if you met a man who was 2,800 years old? What questions would you ask him about history, religion? Would you want to learn his secrets of immortality? If you want to know more, check out secretsofanimmortal.com, an eyewitness account of 2,800 years of history, which is really interesting because we're going to be talking about the last 2,730-plus years tonight. Before we introduce our guest, the mission of the White Roots of Peace Council through Prophecy Keepers Foundation is to fulfill the wishes of the Hopi, Cherokee, and Iroquois White Roots of Peace Gathering elders of the 1960s and 70s in sending their prophetic messages around the world to establish peace throughout the worldwide realization of our ancient common global relatedness. Our guest this evening is Magid Ben Yosef. He's going to be talking with you about some interesting things, including the return of the skull of Geronimo. How are you doing this evening, Ben Yosef?
Doing pretty good, Bluewater. It's great to hear your voice again.
Well, it is. You visited here in Utah with us last week, and we had visits with Grandfather Red Elk had a seminar here, and you did a little bit of traveling with some other elders. And why don't you bring us up to date?
Okay. I'm sorry, my refrigerator just clicked on, so let me walk into the next room.
Okay. Anyway, Ben Yosef was with us last week, and we had interesting. About 100 people attend a seminar with Grandfather Red Elk. And in Fairview, Utah, and Ben Yosef was asked to speak there and stirred up some hearts. It was kind of interesting. Back with us yet, Ben Yosef?
Yep, here. Well, let's see. First of all, I want to thank you again, Bluewater, for allowing me to be on your program. It's a real honor, and I also want to thank you for allow me to be a special messenger for this White Roots of Peace Council.
Absolutely.
I think there is a message, and it's a special message. So I guess what I have to say kind of fits with, you know, the authority that you've given me to speak it. I just got back from Utah and Wyoming yesterday, actually. So I'm a little bit sleep deprived, but I think I'm fresh enough now to talk about a few things.
Well, we can only hope. I know what I felt like after. Oh my gosh, after two. How long were those days? We sat with Red Elk from about 9 to 5, and after 2 days of that, my gosh, I was exhausted. Then we had another 2 nights of meeting. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I after sitting under Red Elk's teachings for 2 days, my spirit was just lifted up. I just felt like I had received a needed revival of my spirit. That man is one of the most spiritual Native Americans who I've ever encountered, and I learned a whole lot from him. And I would encourage anyone who ever gets a chance to listen to Red Elk to make an opportunity to do it. I think the spirit was mighty in those meetings, and the one thing that I came away with the impression I came away with was that it is time for the judgment among all of us to end. There's only one person who's entitled to judge, and that's our Creator. And this judgmental spirit has got to go. And Red Elk, by the Spirit, moved in that direction, and conviction came upon so many people. And I have heard such wonderful things about, you know, that meeting that they needed to hear. They exactly what he told us, and it was awesome.
Yeah, I've been working with him since about 2003, and he gets after me. He'll get after you any kind of divisiveness. He'll just say, no, you're not going to go there. You've got to focus. He focuses people. He brings you back.
Exactly.
But I was still poo. I mean, my spirit was soaring, but I was tired. But, oh, my gosh. And then we had the next couple nights, we were in meetings over here with some wonderful folks. And go ahead, didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. I just really did enjoy the opportunity to share at his meeting. I felt like I had something kind of important to share, and so we talked, and he invited me to come out there, and I thought it was very, very well received. And that's kind of where I wanted to start this off tonight, is with what I talked about at that meeting. And that was simply that there's a move afoot that Native American sovereignty is being restored in this land. And I think the best signal of that is the end of 2,730 years of judgment that was decreed against the assimilated northern tribes of Israel, known as the House of Israel. As you know, Blue Otter, but maybe some of the people who are listening aren't aware of this, but Israel was divided into two families. There was the House of Israel, which was never Jewish, and then there's the House of Judah, which comprises the Jewish element of Israel. And these northern tribes were exiled 136 years before the southern tribes were exiled. And there had been a civil war. The city of Bet-Shemesh in the territory of Judah was attacked by the northern tribes of Israel. One of the walls of Jerusalem was torn down by the northern tribes of Israel, and the northern tribes of Israel formed an alliance with the enemies of the southern tribes of Judah. And this was, brothers against brothers, and it's unreconciled enmity and vexation, which the Bible addresses and says that enmity and vexation will be reconciled. And I believe we're coming right up on that time in history when this reconciliation is about to take place.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. We don't often toot our own horn, but there's a lot of folks out there, a lot of Cherokees, that just laugh, when you assert that we have some relationship with Israel. But let me explain. First, let me explain who I am, who Ben Yosef is, and what the Ketuah Society elders say is the truth.
Okay, if you don't mind, I'll go pop me open a cold drink while you're talking.
Sure, this will take a couple of minutes, but we need to establish spiritual authority here and do it boldly. Okay, I speak for the White Roots of Peace Council. My traditional native name is Jasaya, which means otter, blue man, blue otter, if you will. I descend directly from Uka'ula, Savaduka, who was the war chief and speaker for the Cherokee Nation of circa 1775. He was the heir to the seat of the Cherokee Nation. He was the nephew of Okanastota, who was the headman of the Cherokee Nation. Now, you come down to this day, the original Ketuah Society in 1949 held sovereignty for the entire Cherokee Nation, which was disbanded by Congress in 1906. The Ketuah Society, there were Christianized elements that applied for and received federal recognition, but the Ketuah Society, and particularly one clan, the Longhair Clan, for which my traditional teacher, John Red Hat, was a member. And John Red Hat was recognized by the last three chiefs at Olibee as the true white brother because of his special qualifications. And you can read about that at redhat-speak.com. But John was a very special man. And John gave me put me on the trail of a video which was produced in 1984 by Bill Jones, who was a news commentator for KJRH-TV in Tulsa. A video was produced, about 55 minutes long, and you can listen to it at KeetowaSociety.org, K-E-E-T-O-O-W-A-H, Society.org. And in that society, in that video, for the first time, Chief William Smith publicly displayed the Cherokee wampum belts. And they had a board with Cherokee syllabary that was written in the hand of Sequoia. And he says, that in there, he says, that means we are Israel. He mispronounced it the first time. He says, we're Israel. And he says, we are Israel Psalmers. So then you also had the chief of the Northern Cherokee Nation who wrote a book around the subject, partially around the subject. The book was called We Are Not Yet Conquered. And anyway, that's who we are. Well, some people laugh at us, but we have a former member of the Revived Sanhedrin, Rabbi Michiel Bar-Ron, who's writing. He was a little skeptical of this a couple, 3 years ago when I interviewed him, but he's writing a book about this subject now. So are you back with us, Ben Yosef?
Yeah, I'm here.
So that's who we are. And I come down from Wolf Clan people. A lot of Cherokees just think there's seven clans, but they're actually, but more in recent history, there's 14. Before that, there was over 80, and one of them was the Fire Clan. And I'll let Ben Yosef take it from there.
Well, just to underline what you said, Blue Otter, there are numerous evidences of links between the Cherokee, especially, and the Hebrew priesthood. The most obvious one to me is a book that was written in the 1700s by a man named James Adair. It was called The History of the American Indian. Adair was a Scotsman, and he lived among the Cherokee for more than 30 years before he wrote this book. And he found 23 similarities in the culture, the customs, and the writings of the Cherokee that lined up with priestly traditions that are spelled out in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, also called the Law of Moses. One of the most profound of these is the fact that Cherokee, North Carolina, where there's to this day a sacred mound upon which at one time there was some type of a council house that was built, but it's a very sacred area today. But this mound at Cherokee, North Carolina, today is considered a city of refuge. And if anyone is aware of the concept of the city of refuge in the Bible, you know, that's whenever someone is killed and death is determined to be an accidental death by the council, then so long as the individual involved with the death of an individual stays in a protected city of refuge, he is safe. But if he leaves the city, then he's at the mercy of what is known as the Avenger of Blood, usually a close relative of the person who was killed. Of course, this doesn't apply if it's a murder or there's any premeditation at all. Only if it's an accidental death. And that exactly conforms to what the Torah says about the city of refuge. And again, there are 22 other priestly similarities. But also, I've discovered from since coming back from Israel in 2001 and making many friends among the Native Americans in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico in the Four Corners area, that there are also priestly ties in this area. There was a survey that was done which determined that the extra Y chromosome, which is characteristic of those people who are direct descendants of Aaron, the brother of Moses, in other words, from the priestly line of Israel, they have this haplography called an extra Y chromosome, and it's characteristic only of Aaron. And that extra Y chromosome shows up here in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico more than 30 times greater than in any other known population sample anywhere in the world. Now let me try to explain what this means. In the last days, we're told that there is going to be a priesthood that's known as the priesthood of the Zadokites. And this priesthood is supposed to decide in all matters of controversy. They're also supposed to teach the difference between what is clean and unclean and what is holy and what is common, which is exactly what Moses was charged to do with the children of Israel. I'm hearing an awful lot of popping on the line. Are we getting through okay?
I can hear you. I was debating on whether or not I wanted to have, maybe this is a good time to take a break. Don, during the break, would you disconnect, stay on the line with me, disconnect Ben Yosef, and then reconnect with him, and let's go ahead and do that, Don, and then maybe we can solve this audio problem. I think it's,
Hello?
Yeah, I think, Don, can you hear me? Let's take a break, and would you disconnect Ben? Stay on the line with me. Disconnect Ben Yosef, and the audio problems seem to be coming from his end. Disconnect him and reconnect him, okay?
Hello.
Let's continue. I guess. Anyway, go ahead and continue.
I apologize to anyone who's hearing if this popping is annoying. But
yeah, it builds up to a certain point and then it goes back, so let's just continue and not worry about it.
Anyway, it became pretty much apparent that there is some kind of a tie between the Native American population and the Hebrews. And you see evidences of it all over this country. Anyone who's traveled to Misty Mountain there in New Mexico can find a stone that is engraved with the Ten Commandments in Paleo Hebrew. And it dates to the time before the Common Era. So, you know, we're talking about very ancient things, and there's many other evidences as well. But I guess the one thing I had wanted to talk with your listeners about tonight that kind of relates to this tangentially is, you know, this move toward the... I would say the spiritual sovereignty being restored to the native people. And this happens at the end of 2,730 years of judgment against the house of Israel known as Ephraim. Now, the way this is all determined, Blue Otter, was there was a judgment that was decreed against both the northern tribes of Israel and the southern tribes of Israel. It happened when the prophet Ezekiel was told to lay on his side facing the north a number of days, and then lay on his side facing the south a number of days.
Echoes of another time, let the wind blow. At the truth we know, all mankind again, prophecy keeper, oh yeah. Ancient truth surrounds us like a lover's hand upon the heart. You gave me grows intently through the years,
and becomes dreams.
So let the wind.
Friends, January 1st, 2010 is the deadline for turning over your personal biometric measurements at a regional United States government facility. If you do not comply with the Real ID Act, you will not be able to legally drive. Recently, some people caught driving illegally have been tortured with tasers before being arrested by the New World Order police state. If you cannot legally drive, will you be able to work? To buy? To sell? Friends, check your scriptures. This sounds like the mark of the beast, as it was described thousands of years ago in Revelations chapter 13. at survivalismskills.com. Learn about the Hopi Elders 10-point plan for your survival. Learn Native American survival skills at survivalismskills.com. Download your free copy of Nuclear War Survival Skills from Oak Ridge Laboratories today at survivalismskills.com. Visit survivalismskills.com today.
Oh, folks, we're back. We're having some bandwidth problems. I'm on Skype. Ben Yosef's on a VOIP, a voiceover internet protocol. So anyway, we're back. We were talking about spiritual sovereignty. Take it away, Ben Yosef.
Okay, well, thank you again, Blue Otter. And again, I apologize to anyone who's heard all this popping on the line.
Should be all right.
But anyway, I was saying that the prophet Ezekiel was told to lay on his side facing north and lay on his side facing south. And the number of days that he lay on his side in each direction would be decreed as 1 year of judgment against each house of Israel. And he lay on his side facing the north 390 days, which meant there was a decree of judgment of 390 years. Well, that length of time came and went, and the house of Israel did not repent of its transgression. The house of Judah did repent within the number of years they were allocated, and they were returned to the land. Of course, the temple was rebuilt, and you had the scenario for when Jesus arrived, which is recorded in the New Testament. But what about the house of Israel? What happened to them? Well, the 390 years came and went. They did not repent. And in the Torah, again, the first five books of the Bible, or the Law of Moses, as it's called, there's a ruling that if a judgment is decreed, and of course the decree came by Ezekiel acting out this sentence, but if a judgment is decreed and the people do not repent within the time of that decree, then the judgment itself is multiplied times seven, which means that 390 years now becomes 2,730 years. And reckoned from the time of the exile of the northern tribes of Israel in 722 before the Common Era, that judgment of 2,730 years expired on October 10th, 2008. And with the expiration of that judgment, then Ephraim, the northern tribes of Israel, is now my people again. In other words, the judgments that cut the northern tribes of Israel out of the covenant with the God of Israel were that God would scatter them, he would remove his mercy from them, and he would declare, "You're not my people, I'm not your God." In other words, he was finished with the house of Israel. The God of Israel was finished with the northern house of Israel, but not with the southern house of Judah. They've remained in his covenant. Not so the northern tribes of Israel. Now, the northern tribes of Israel, however, since this decree has now ended, are in the same boat. Their salvation, if you will, I don't really like that word salvation because I think it has a lot of connotations that go into theological concepts, which, you know, we're not really dealing with here. We're just dealing with the attitude that God has toward the northern tribes of the house of Israel and his plans for the northern tribes of the house of Israel.
Let me interrupt you for just a second.
Until now. Sorry.
Folks, if you're listening out there, and I guess, Ben Yosef, wouldn't you agree there's probably about a 90% chance that if they're listening, that they are. This applies to the people that are listening. They probably don't realize it. Is that correct?
Well, that's what I prayed before you called, was that this word would go out to those who are supposed to hear it and who have the ears to hear it. And, you know, if anyone has questions they'd like to ask us, I sure hope they'll call in and we get a chance to talk with someone. But all I'm saying is that now that the judgment of Ephraim has ended, that means that Ephraim can assume this all-important birthright, which was assigned to Ephraim. At the same time that this renewed covenant is supposed to be made with the house of Israel, Ephraim is called God's firstborn. That's in Jeremiah chapter 31 for those who want to look it up. If Ephraim is God's firstborn, you know what? Blue Otter, they got to start acting like God's firstborn.
That's right. And, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about the scriptures because of bad translations. And there's a scripture that says that the scepter will remain between the feet of Judah until people pronounce it Shiloh, but it's Shiloh. And most people, when they read that, they think in their mind, oh, that must mean Jesus. Tell them what it means, Ben Yosef.
Well, Shiloh is just a city in Jerusalem, and it's the place where Jeroboam, who was the first king of the northern tribes of Israel, was received his coronation at, in the city of Shiloh. And,
and Encyclopedia Judaica says it means city of Ephraim, and it was the place where the ark and the tabernacle resided for about 160 years.
I'm not up on the total number of years it was there, but it's true that the Ark of the Covenant was at Shiloh for some time, and it obviously was a city that figured prominently in the northern kingdom of Israel later, and the fact that Jeroboam was coronated there could have indicated at that time, you know, said that that scepter would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes.
Well, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but the other thing I get, and I don't want to underline, is that the Ephraim's got some different meanings here. And when we're talking about Ephraim, we're not just talking about Ephraim. We're talking about sometimes we're specifically referring to Ephraim, but sometimes you can say Ephraim and refer to all the tribes that were part of the northern kingdom. So now I'll shut up.
That's true. The northern house of Israel often has the generic name Ephraim. And you see a reference to this in Ezekiel chapter 37, where there's a reference to two sticks that will eventually rejoin together. One is called for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and the house of Israel together with him. And the other one is the stick of Judah and the children of Israel together with him. So you can see in both of them include part of Israel. The house of Israel, which biblically and historically defines the entirety of the northern tribes, however, goes under the stick of Joseph Ephraim. And for that reason, Ephraim is sometimes used generically to represent all of the house of Israel. Hello?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Keep talking.
Oh, keep talking. Okay. Sorry. Anyway, now that this period of judgment is over, and Ephraim should be ready to assume this birthright responsibility, the question is, what should they do? And the Spirit is telling me, if I'm hearing the Spirit correctly, the Spirit is telling me that Ephraim must reach out to his brothers. And his brothers, of course, are Manasseh, who is the other son of Joseph, and the older son of Joseph, biblically, and Benjamin. And Benjamin is part of this family of Joseph because whenever there was a divining cup of Joseph found in Benjamin's sack, a decree was made by all of Benjamin's brothers. They said they were so confident that the head of Joseph's household would never find a divining cup in any of their sacks that they said, if that cup is found in anybody's sack, the person in whose sack it's found will die, and the rest of us will be your servants. They were so confident. So the head of Joseph's household said, it will be as you say. So in some manner, Benjamin had to die, and they would have to be servants to Joseph. But then the head of Joseph's household went on to say that the one in whose sack the cup was found would become the servant to his master, and the rest of them would be exonerated. But the death came about because Benjamin then became part of the family of Joseph and was removed from this other status with the rest of the brothers of Israel. And the idea of sovereignty is expressed even here with the rest of the tribes of Israel somehow paying homage to this house of Joseph. Now, it's kind of interesting to me that the house of Joseph is like the monarchy of the northern tribes of Israel in the same way that the house of the house of David was the monarchy for the southern tribes of Judah. And there are all kinds of things written in the oral traditions of the Jewish people that whenever this reunion takes place between the children of Joseph and the children of Judah, it will be as though even the angels in heaven would shut their mouths and watch what was going on, because there would be two kings that would be approaching one another.
And actually, people don't realize there's actually supposed to be two messiahs, Messiah ben Yosef and Messiah ben David, and this debate was going on at the time of Jesus.
Boy, you're going to open a can of worms there.
Well, okay, go ahead.
You're right. There will be two messiahs to appear in the last days. The first messiah, now I'm speaking here in terms of eschatology, or an understanding of end times events, not from the perspective of what Christians believe, or even what Native Americans believe, but what is taught in the Orthodox yeshivas in Jerusalem. And in the Orthodox yeshivas in Jerusalem, we're told and taught that there will be two messiahs. The first will be the Messiah, the son of Joseph. Now, also we have to realize that when we use the word Messiah, we're not using it in a any kind of a title. We're using it simply to mean someone who is anointed. The word Messiah means anointed one. So the question is, what is this Messiah, son of Joseph, anointed to do, and what is this Messiah, son of David, anointed to do? Well, if you believe, as I do, that Jesus was the Messiah, the son of David, who first came in order to bring this assimilation of the northern tribes of Israel back into covenant. And by the way, that does seem to be the purpose for his first coming, as expressed in the prophecies about him before his birth and at his infancy. You can read these in Luke chapter 1 and Luke chapter 2. And they will specifically address the rectification of the judgments that cut Israel off of the covenant. And those are found in Hosea chapter 1. Remember, Hosea was told to marry this harlot. Her name was Gomer. Well, that's where the northern tribes of Israel went whenever they were exiled. They went to the land of Gomer, which was in Assyria. And then from there, they crossed over into Europe, and they settled out throughout Europe, but primarily in the Scandinavian countries, the coast of Normandy, crossed the British Channel into Scotland, went down to Wales and crossed over to Ireland. So through European, not just British colonization, but through European colonization, every nation of the world has the seed of these people who were exiled in Assyria. And it's kind of technical, and if people would like to look at this on my website, they can get more information. That website is www.torah, T-O-R-A-H, hyphen, voice, V-O-I-C-E, .org. And there's many articles on there that will explain this concept in more detail. But I only mention it now to indicate that the mission of Jesus as this Messiah, son of David, was simply to renew this covenant. In his own words, he said in Matthew chapter 15, I am sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, biblically and historically, that house of Israel is the northern tribes of Israel.
That's right.
Theologically, the church has tried to make the lost sheep of the house of Israel unsaved Jews, in their opinion, which is, in my mind, a judgment of the church against the Jewish people, which is not a proper judgment. But that's another topic. But anyway, Jesus came the first time as this Messiah, son of David, promising that he would come again. Well, naturally, he has to wait for this gospel of the restoration of the kingdom to Israel to make its way into all of the nations before the end can come. And he told his disciples, whenever they asked him, Master, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? He couldn't tell them when, because that wasn't in his authority. He said it's in the authority of the Father alone. But he told them how. He said when the Holy Spirit would come upon them, that they would be his witnesses to this restoration of the kingdom to Israel. First in Jerusalem, then Judea, Samaria, then the uttermost parts of the earth. Now, it's interesting to me that he specifically mentioned Judea Samaria, Blue Otter, because today, when you mention Judea Samaria, you're referring to the West Bank, which the Palestinians are wanting as their state. But Judea, of course, calls to mind the house of Judah, and Samaria calls to mind the house of Israel, because when the house of Israel was exiled, it was repopulated by Samaritans who were brought there by the Assyrians who exiled the house of Israel. So when you see that phrase, Judea, Samaria, used in any context, you have to think of it in terms of the ancient homeland of the house of Judah and the house of Israel. And if God is after a reconciliation between these two families, in other words, if his intent is to bring them back to their historic inheritances, which is indicated in Hosea chapter 2, he goes on to say, although he's removed his mercy from them, although he's declared them not his people, although he's scattered them into all the nations, he says that they will be so numerous, they will outnumber the sand on the seashore. And in the same place where it was told them, you're not my people, there, in the land of Israel, they will be called sons of the living God. So this demands a return, at least by a remnant, of this house of Joseph. And my personal interest in this, of course, relates to Native American sovereignty and the many evidences that Native Americans have these roots of the house of Joseph. One of the strongest indicators is the writings in what I call the Diary of Nephi. Nephi, the son of Lehi ben Menashe ben Yosef.
For all your Mormons out there, we're talking about Nephi and Lehi.
Oh, I apologize.
That's okay.
I just have to use the Hebrew pronunciations because it's much easier for me. But,
right. Well, let me interject a point here. You know,
sure.
From what I've read of Jewish prophecy, it was a longstanding prophecy that at some time among the Gentiles, a group of people would stand up and claim to be Ephraim. And to my knowledge, the Mormons were the first people to do this. But go ahead.
Well, actually, there are probably 2.5 million people in the world today who know that they are part of this Joseph Ephraim. And this revelation came to me in two ways. The first was in 1998 through a dream in which I counted sheep all night. And, I mean, you've seen these cartoons where someone's sleeping beside a tree stump and the sheep jump over and they're counting sheep at a time. Well, this isn't the way it happened, Blue Otter. There were droves of sheep, and they were running and jumping over something like a ditch. And as they would jump over, I instinctively, in the dream, I would never be able to do this while awake, but in the dream, I instinctively knew the number of sheep in each drove that came by. And I counted these things all night long, and when I woke up, the total was 2,520,760. Now, we cannot number the house of Israel, but we may be able to number the house of Joseph that will make their return. And another question has to be asked, why would the house of Joseph want to return to that land with all the violence and the trouble over there? Well, one possible answer is, we're a solution to it. Especially the Native Americans who would comprise what is known as the descendants of Laman ben Lehi ben Menashe ben Yosef, or who the Book of Mormon refers to as the oldest son of Lehi.
The Lamanites, that's what the Mormons call them.
The Lamanites. Because there's an ancient prophecy in the Book of Mormon that whenever Lehi came to this river in Egypt, this is before they made their way over to the Americas, but he came to this river in Egypt, and he was pretty disappointed with his son Laman. And so he prophesied when he saw this river that was empty, but then the Red Sea would come in with the tide and fill it up, and then, of course, it'd go back out. And then the tide would come in and it would fill up again, and then it would go out again, and then the tide would come back in and fill up, and then it would go out again, and then back in, and then back out. The reason I said that four times is because the Hopi prophecies indicate that the Hopi were to make four migrations to each of the four directions. but each time returning to the place from which they sent. In the same way, Lehi prophesied to his son Laman that he should be like that river continually returning to the source of all righteousness. So that's one of many links that I have found in my research of the Book of Hopi, which was published in 1976 by Dr. Frank Waters, and in the Book of Mormon, which I'm really just getting into. I think I'm on my third read now, but I'm far from an expert on this book, and I've tried to stay out of the doctrine altogether. I'm interested only in the historicity of it.
So you're saying the Book of Mormon didn't have the same effect on you that it did on Mark Twain?
Well, I'm not sure what.
Did you ever hear that joke?
Mark Twain.
He said that if you ever had problems with insomnia, all he had to do was read the Book of Mormon.
No, it's kept me awake many nights, as a matter of fact. I really enjoyed reading it. And I believe there's a lot of truth contained in it. But I also believe that, just like it tells us in the Book of Revelation, that the spirit of the prophet is subject to that prophet. And if Joseph Smith was a prophet, you know, I'm certain that a lot of the things in the Book of Mormon are true, and I'll not take issue with them. But I'm also certain that as a prophet, a lot of his revelations are subject to his own spirit.
And he said that. He said that if the Book of Mormon had any errors, they're errors of men. And he also said that and Brigham Young also reiterated what Joseph said, that if the people deserve to be led astray, they'd be led astray. So I'll let you continue.
There's some truth to that. It's like what we sow is what we reap. Which brings me to another topic, which is tangentially related to the return of sovereignty in this land. There was an attempt made during the summer of 2007 by the Membrino Apache community in southern Colorado to secure the return of the skull of Geronimo. We felt that after 400 years that it might be the time to make this appeal. It was made by a direct descendant of Geronimo, in fact, his greatest granddaughter. Her name is Ada Fasthorse. And Ada had asked that someone take a message to Washington, D.C. and deliver it to the White House because President George W. Bush was a member of the Skull and Bone Society along with his father, President George H.W. Bush, and the Skull and Bone Society uses the skull of Geronimo in these very unclean rituals that go on there at Yale University. If anyone will take the time to research the history, you'll find that a man by the name of Prescott Bush, the grandfather to President George W. Bush and the father to President George H.W. Bush, led a raiding party to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where they dug up Geronimo and a few other young Apaches. They took their skulls and femur bones to Yale University, where they have this unclean ritual in which vows are made to Satan, and they're given these secret names. The thing that is alarming to me, and this brings it right back to Israel again, is that the secret name that was taken by George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush was the name Gog, which we would spell, or you may pronounce it Gog, which would be spelled G-O-G in English. But here's the interesting part, Blue Otter. The name Gog is also an abbreviation for the name George, because in modern Hebrew, a native Israeli speaker has difficulty with the name George. The R sound coming after a long O just does not come out easily for native Israelis. Instead, George is pronounced Joch, as you would spell it, J-O-J. However, in Hebrew, there is no J. So instead, you adopt the G sound, which is the Gimel. And so the name George would be spelled Gimel Vav Gimel, the exact way that you spell Gog, Now, if you take the rest of George W. Bush's name, which would be Gog Walker Bush, the gematria of that name is 666. Now, by gematria, I mean that every Hebrew letter in the alphabet is assigned a numerical value. The first 10 letters are assigned the number 1 through 10. Then the next 10 letters, 20 through 100. And then the final three, 200, 300, and 400. If you add up the totality of the name, Gog Walker Bush, it is 666, which means that this is an individual who will figure prominently and in a, let's say, a disreputable way into the affairs of the state of Israel. And we've seen this happen already with the demands by George H.W. Bush that the settlements, the Jewish settlements in the land of Judea Samaria, be abandoned and no new settlements built. This happened right after the Gulf War ended when George H.W. Bush was president. He sent James Baker to Israel with this demand. And in doing so, and by the way, this was simply to placate the Arab nations who had agreed not to align themselves with Saddam Hussein if the United States would force Israel to negotiate a Palestinian state in the territories of Judea Samaria. Here's the problem with that, Blue Otter. The land of Joseph, known as the birthright territories, are part of this Arab state, this Palestinian state that's being proposed and has been backed by our State Department. Why is this a problem? Well, in the little book of Obadiah, the smallest book in all the Bible, the little book of Obadiah, we're told that whenever the children of Jacob would start returning to their inheritances, they would find them occupied by the house of Esau. This means that biblically and historically, the house of Esau is today living in the territories of Joseph. And the State Department is wanting to make that a permanent arrangement, which means tampering with a birthright, which results in a curse. All Native American tribes know, and you know, Blue Otter, when you tamper with a birthright, that is the darkest of the black roads. And I've just gone to say that now that Native American sovereignty has been restored after 400 years, after the what I call the failed experiment called Manifest Destiny. Manifest Destiny was the declaration by these European settlers comprising the root stock, at least, of the children of Ephraim, whenever they came from European nations and from the British Isles, too. But when they came here, they declared that it was their destiny that this land would be theirs, without regard for the people who were here already, signing treaties with them and breaking every one of those treaties that ever had been signed. Now, the God of Israel is a God of his word, and he does not break his word. And therefore, I know and convinced that those treaties that were signed and broken on behalf of this Manifest Destiny experiment mark Manifest Destiny as an abject failure. And after 400 years of it, enough. After 400 years of it, just like Abraham waited 400 years for the sovereignty to return to him and his descendants, the sovereignty is returning to the native peoples. And this is reflected in the prophecies of the Hopi. The Hopi were told whenever the last of their clans returned, all of the places that they had staked out would be theirs. They would have the sovereignty. And now you're seeing these clans coming up from the south in massive, massive, massive droves. By the millions, you have the Hopi descendants returning from the south. And this means that the sovereignty of this land has changed hands. We're now a majority Hispanic people, and these Hispanics represent this seed of the assimilation of the Hopi with these people mentioned in the Book of Mormon as the Lamanites.
At this point, let me interject. folks, if you don't see the parallel between the end of the 2730 years, as of early October, and the largest financial collapse in history, the end of the American Empire, everything has changed, the board is being swept, then you're just not getting it. Now we've got about 5 minutes left, so go ahead and wrap up, and then I need a minute before.
Right. Let me just, again, reiterate what you said. Every aspect of American experience right now is laboring under a curse. And I believe that curse has come upon us because of the Bush presidencies. During the presidency of George H.W. Bush, we preferred Iraq over the territories of Joseph. Had we spent all those resources helping Israel develop the territories of Joseph, we would be blessed.
There's tons of oil in that territory.
That's right. The prophecies about Joseph and his blessing relate specifically to the blessing of the deep on the crown of the head of Joseph. And if you look at my website at www.torah-voice.org, you'll see an outline of Judea Samaria that forms the head of a man wearing a crown. And right at the tip of that crown is Megiddo, or the area that is also known in Greek as Armageddon. And this is going to be massive tank farms, oil storage tanks. It's going to be energy related, and I believe this will be the spoil that the forces of Gog are going to invade Israel for. Ideologically, during the Bush administrations, our State Department has been this Gog, attacking Israel on every front ideologically. And unfortunately, ideological attacks over time tend to become reality. But I want to, if I can, real quick, mention that I'm going to be doing some traveling and speaking up in Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. And if there's anybody who is interested in having us speak on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council as a special messenger with your authority, Blue Otter, all they need to do is get a hold of me via email, and that's BenYosef, BenYosef, at yahoo.com. Get a hold of me, and we'll see if we can put you on our itinerary. All we're asking is that you help us out with our travel expenses a little bit and pass a plate. And it's a real honor to be here tonight and talk to your audience. And if anyone has any questions or comments they'd like to make, if they'll contact me, I will be happy to answer them as soon as I can.
And in the minute or so we've got left, I'd like to invite folks to go to OriginalGhostDance.com and also ProphecyKeepers.com. And you can read about the prophecy that was given to me in 1998 that had to do with the weather in 2005. After the fulfillment of that prophecy, one of the Sanhedrin rabbis recognized that I was a proven prophet. And after that happened, in May of 2006, I was told to seek a grant of $500,000 for travel expenses for the elders to literally save the planet. And I haven't talked about this very much, and I didn't even really know who the elders were, but beginning to think that it's been Joseph and I and others that are going to be trained to take this message traveling.
Let me interject here just a second.
Sure.
I myself do not claim to be an elder. I'm simply a special messenger. But I do believe that the Spirit is having me allocate all of my resources to try to accommodate elders.
Absolutely. Now the member, I've accepted you as an elder, and I'm accepted in sacred Cherokee circles as an elder. So, take it for what it's worth. This is an extremely important message. And go ahead. We've only got about a minute left.
Okay. Well, if we have a minute left, let me just simply close by asking people again to please take a look at the website because we've not had enough time to nearly explore all this. You'll find there that just like Grandfather Prescott Bush took the skull of Geronimo, his grandson, George H.W. Bush, is trying to behead Joseph according to this outline described on the website. And like father, like grandfather, like grandson, and meet a connected meter. What goes around comes around. But if we really want to do something about this curse which has come upon this nation for cursing Israel, we need to return Geronimo's skull. Geronimo needs to complete his journey. And Ada Fast Horse warned in her message to the White House to do this in July 2007 before the curse gets much worse.
Absolutely. And folks, like I said, you know, we do need funds. Ever since Benyozo and I hooked up in January, our lives have just fallen apart in a lot of ways. And that was told years ago. You really know that you're on the right track when your life just kind of falls apart. So anyway, if anybody's worried about oversight, the great spirit would be overseeing every nickel of anything that's donated through Prophecy Keepers Foundation. Well, Don, I guess we're coming up on the end of the show. Anything in the last few seconds, Benyozo, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to say Aho Metakiasi, which just means all my relatives, because we're all related. We're all in this mess together, and together we can do something about it.
Boom.
Let the truth be known to all mankind again. Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy Keeper, Prophecy
Cherokee. We bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times. From the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Levant, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.